Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Here we are, Joe Hagan, Emily Jane Fox. We are inside the Hive.
Back and ready for action.
Back for action. And the skies are clearing, at least literally.
Today, I just got to show Joe. I showed him a little video of what the sky is finally looking like here in Los Angeles. I see blue sky for the first time today. It has been so smoky. The air quality app, which I've been obsessively monitoring over the last week, finally shows good this morning. So I'm going to take that as an omen. And it's the true silver lining of our conversation today, right? Because you are getting into an interview that is not blue sky. There is no sunshine.
Sobering. Sobering, to say the least. The irony, just, you know, to stay for a moment on the weather patterns, the irony is that the red haze that has been covering California during these wildfires has made its way east. Mm. And last night, we could see them in our own skies. And I was getting reports from friends of mine in Massachusetts, even Vermont, that they were seeing the red haze that had traveled all the way from California. You know, if you need any evidence that the world is interconnected and that, you know, the weather is our climate, there it was in red.
Well, Joe, it makes me feel connected to you under the same fucked up sky, in the same scientific reality, though our president seems to not believe in science. Science who, really? Who's that guy?
Yeah. Who is that, Mr. Science? This week I'm talking to a historian named Peter Fritchie. He wrote a book, came out this summer. It was reviewed in the Times. It was called Hitler's First 100 Days When Germans Embraced the Third Reich. Now, inside the Hive, we're not going to turn into the History Channel or promise you some sort of BBC-like documentary, you know, with black and white film footage and so forth. But there's a way in which this is very much in the news, which is this is very relevant to things that are happening this week. You know, for the last many years, the term Nazi, fascist, and so forth has been used as a kind of, a cheap political bludgeon, right? On Twitter or where on TV, you know, people say, oh, that person's acting like a Nazi. They are a Nazi. I mean, in the last 3 or 4 years, I tried to resist going there. But recently, alarm bells have been going off in my mind. And I think for a lot of people who are looking at the news and beginning to wonder if the echoes of fascism and Nazism that we learn about are happening right now during this election in Trump's America and in the form of Trump, but also William Barr. Have you been following some of the things that William Barr has been saying this week?
I have been following them, and I've been talking to people in Trump world about what is happening. And yeah. Someone put it to me very succinctly yesterday, and it's someone who's been around President Trump long before he was president, when he was just plain old Donald Trump. And he said to me, the only thing that he could say was he really finally got his Roy Cohn, but this Roy Cohn just happens to be in the shape of a Republican man who used to be respected. And yeah. He is a lackey of the highest degree. It is norm shattering. It is sort of heartbreaking. It's appalling. And I think we have all felt that way for many, 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 many months. This week in particular, it feels like it feels like he has just sort of lost the thread. I kind of felt this way about Ivanka Trump during watching Ivanka Trump during the RNC, where I've covered her so closely for 5 years, and I've seen this evolution of like so many people don't accept her, and she gets criticized for everything she does, mostly rightly, and so she sort of hardened into this position of, well, they're going to say bad shit about me anyway, so I'm just going to do what I want to do and whatever is going to serve me best at present moment. And I feel like we've seen that with Bill Barr this week. We've seen he's been rightly criticized for every action he's taken in order to protect his boss, President Trump, for the last however many months at this point he's been attorney general. And I think that what we're seeing is someone who is hardened into his position.
You know, he's letting his freak flag fly. Can we say that? I mean, whereas he was supposed to be, you know, a ostensibly nonpartisan, you know, judicious, objective observer of the law. See, and there's another critique that I think we should take into account.
My puppy hates him.
But this week he comes out in an interview and says, you know, that the U.S. is going down the quote unquote socialist path if Trump is not reelected. He's talking about charging protesters with sedition. This is a guy who is flexing his muscle on behalf of Trump in a way that is frightening, frankly, and a lot of people are frightened by it. We see newscasters who is normally trying to, you know, show a level of objectivity, but whose jaws are hanging down listening to this man speak. And the reason it's relevant to today's interview is that it was exactly this kind of, you know, fear-mongering to the public that if you do not vote in and elect Adolf Hitler and the National Socialists into power in Germany in 1933, you are going to face chaos on the streets from socialists, from Bolsheviks, right? In fact, you know, I mentioned in an interview a couple of weeks ago, this guy Matt Schlapp, the head of CPAC. Okay, I saw the other day he posted a picture that he had put a sign in his yard. It said, America or socialism, right? That's your choice. America or socialism. Well, this is exactly what the Nazis did. They said, you have one choice, Marxism or the German people, right? And this historian, Peter Fritzsche, who I'm going to be speaking with and who you'll be hearing from momentarily, draws all of these interesting parallels. There are distinctions, but what's frightening, Emily, is that there are becoming less and less distinctions in the historical analogy than is comfortable. And, you know, last interview I did was with Stuart Stevens, the former GOP strategist, who has sort of renounced his membership in the Republican Party. And he began to, in his interview, talk about some of the analogies with early rise of the Nazi Party. And he himself was frightened as somebody who had studied this history. And so that was the reason I thought I'd bring this guy on and talk to him today. And he's incredibly illuminating, smart. And lastly, there was a poll this week that showed young millennials and Generation Z in this country, the unbelievable ignorance about the Holocaust.
Those numbers
mind-blowing.
I honestly don't know how we got to a place where those are present-day realities. You have to hope that the numbers and the polling is not right. My puppy again. She's just like, she's on it today.
Distressed.
I don't blame her. She feels my energy. She feels the earth's energy, and she's just speaking her mind. More power to her. I have to hope the numbers are wrong. I fear that they're not. Do you have the numbers in front of you?
Well, 63%, according to this poll, did not know that 6 million Jews had died in the Holocaust. An alarming amount had never heard of Auschwitz. A number of them, I think it was something like, you know, maybe 11% thought the Jews were behind the Holocaust. I mean, a complete, you know, as if they had studied history through a telescope with a book, like, you know, a mile away. I mean, it's alarming and distressing, which is yet again a reason I felt like compelled this week to give ourselves some historical context. You know, we're caught up in the news from week to week. Let's pan back and think about where we are and go into this fall and into this election with eyes wide open.
Let's get to it, because anything that I could say pales in comparison to, I'm sure, what you guys talked about. So let's just hop right in.
Peter Fritchie, welcome to Inside the Hive. We're happy to have you here today.
Well, great pleasure. Thanks.
So we are here. It's an unusual interview for us. We're talking to Peter Fritchie, a historian of Nazi Germany and author of a book that came out this summer, Hitler's First 100 Days When Germans Embraced the Third Reich. And it's an unusual book about that time, because it really looks at the blow-by-blow, day-by-day kind of politicking and behind the scenes, but also the street-level events that were leading to the rise of Hitler and the Nazis and the takeover of Germany in 1933. And there are unique historical and economic trends at work at that time, and it's a different culture than America in many ways. But the broad outlines of what was happening bear a striking resemblance, as I was reading it, to some of the things that we're seeing right now. And as you have pointed out to me, Peter, one of the most kind of interesting parallels is just the sense of surprise and shock and the unlikeliness of Hitler's, you know, rise to power. He was an unlikely figure in an otherwise democratic country. And that parallel is one we're seeing and have seen with the rise of Trump in this country. And, you know, when you were writing this book, I have to assume some of it was being written while Trump was rising to power. Did you see some of these parallels? And can we, as I was reading it, a lot of it seemed to be right there in black and white, the similarities. Did you yourself recognize them and see them as you were writing the book?
I have to plead guilty. I was driving to the airport in November 2016 and decided on the format of the book. And the contract was signed 2 or 3 days before the inauguration in January 2017. And it was the idea of the unexpected and what was now to come when we didn't imagine either Trump as president or the mood of the country as what it was 3 or 4 or 5 years before that. And one of the great mysteries in German history is indeed how Hitler, who was had a large voting bloc behind him, but it was a minority bloc, was able to win over the majority of the nation and do so rather quickly and do so rather firmly. And so these 100 days, or you could say 200 days, have been, historians go back to it again and again, because the temperature of Germany changed. The kinds of decisions that people made changed. You had a very, very partisan, divided country. You had communists, socialists, Nazis. And then suddenly, by the summer of 1933, you have this seeming unanimity, this seeming unity, where people who oppose the Nazis are suddenly marginalized as traitors. And this is just such a big change from January 1933, from November 1932, from the 5 elections that Germany had in the year 1932, where there was just so much partisan hoopla, and everybody had a political position and showed it on their lapels, on the flags that they showed in their apartments, and then suddenly that was all gone. So yeah. People were surprised, and people were disoriented about what they were seeing in front of them. Hitler had always been underestimated, but he surely was the leader of the largest party in Germany. So in that sense, he was very much present in all conversations that people had at dinner parties or over the kitchen table revolved around him. But nonetheless, how it all transpired And to get from January to May, yes, that was a surprising and disorienting series of events.
Right. In your book, you really beautifully describe the mood of Germany in the lead up to the elections of late 1932 through letters and diaries and newspapers, and how the National Socialist Party and Adolf Hitler exploited this sort of fear of a radical left, a sense that the right could establish law and order against potential violence. And in these rallies that Hitler held, he underlined and underscored these points repeatedly. And one of his political messages was, there can be only one victor, Marxism or the German people. And, you know, it reminded me of yard signs I've seen, America or socialism, you know, that's your choice. Describe for me how the Nazis framed these ideas in the lead up to Hitler's takeover in 1933.
Well, first of all, the Nazis very energetically tried to frame themselves as stewards of the German people. And the German people did not include the enemies of the German people. It didn't include the Jews, and it didn't include the traitors who had mutinied in the revolution of 1918. 15 years before. And so when you say, you know, it's either Bolshevism or the German people, Bolsheviks, and inside the Bolsheviks are also the moderate socialists and, you know, all other enemies, those aren't the German people. They're non-Germans, they're traitors, and they are the enemies of the German people, and the German people must rally in order to protect themselves from these alien forces. So it's a us-them argument that becomes increasingly plausible and credible once Hitler's in power, when he can use the power of the radio and the power of the office to suggest that we're on the very eve of a communist uprising, and that the communists are about to create a coup d'etat and to kidnap all sorts of leading citizens and to blow up bridges. This was all without evidence, because there is no evidence, but he really created, the Nazis really created a sense right before those last elections in March 1933 that Germany was on the verge of being overrun by the Bolsheviks. And this played into, anyways, how middle-class Germans thought of the communists and the socialists. Germany was so divided that even moderate socialists and middle-class nationalists rarely work together, even at the local level. So this kind of us-them gained credibility, and Hitler more and more effectively in his rallies, in the radio, once he's in power, is able to pose as the steward of the German people who will protect them and then lead them into a new era of prosperity. And that is the key with the Third Reich. He does not want the Kaiser back. The Kaiser thinks the Kaiser's coming back, but the Kaiser's wrong. He wants a Third Reich, and he doesn't want to. You can honor the past. That's fine, and that's exactly where the Kaiser should stay, in the past, an honorable past. But this is a new future led by a frontline soldier, not a general, and not a representative of the elites. Hitler's popularity and his success is because he is a regular man, a regular frontline officer like so millions of other Germans, and has no status and class pretensions and doesn't talk in those ways. And so it's not a restoration of the Kaiserreich. What it is the destruction of the Weimar Republic in order, which is an unhealthy, degenerate form, in order to get to a healthy, unified, remilitarized Germany.
It's probably important to note for people who might not have the historical context here that the Weimar Republic was the previous government regime, perceived to have been adrift and unresponsive at a time when the Great Depression had come along. And by the way, National Socialists was a kind of a confusing name because they weren't socialists per se.
They were not socialists, but they talked about collective responsibilities. And they talked about the prior right of the nation as a collective entity over and above family and individual, and certainly a priority over any internationalist allegiances and alliances. So right. The key, actually, to understanding the Nazis is to look back at their name, National Socialist German Workers' Party. It has all those elements. It suggests it's moving beyond the old right. It has a new right position, and it will embrace workers as sons of the nation, as former veterans in the World War, and it will bring workers back into the fold of the German nation, but it will not be standard socialism. It'll be collective responsibilities based on the priority of the nation, and that is what's going to make Germany strong. But Germany can't do it without all classes coming together, including the working class. So that is its great ambition. And in some ways, the Nazis were, in fact, the most diverse, socially diverse political party in Germany. They had more Catholics than any non-Catholic party, and they had more workers than any non-socialist party. So their claim to be a people's party and to represent all classes is credible in some ways.
I'd like to back up here for a second, because the reason I wanted to have you on is because many people are using terms like Nazism and fascism to talk about Trump. And of course, there are ways in which it's a broad stroke analogy and a political attack, but there are also lessons to be drawn, real lessons and alarm bells that history is ringing for us today. You know, this belligerent populism, fear of the other, you know, pulling away from other countries, which is something the Nazis also promised to do, to pull out of European treaties. But as a historian, when drawing these analogies between what happened then and what we're seeing now, tell us what's useful and what isn't.
Well, analogies aren't maps. But if you don't talk about analogies, you're blind. And this was a complex industrial society with lots of cultural innovation and technological innovation that had a large democratic following at the beginning of the revolution in 1918-1919. Two-thirds of all Germans voted for the Democratic Republic and its supporters. But this two-thirds, they lost half. So it was only one-third of Germans at the end who supported the Democratic parties. So within 10, 12 years, you can have this enormous sea change in the points of orientation that people make. And so it's not democracy per se, and then voting for parties within it. It's an outright rejection of democracy and parliamentary methods as de-unifying, splintering, fragmenting, and actually sapping the strength of the German nation. And so all sorts of procedural things about democracy, about law, all that is less important than for the Nazis and their supporters than reestablishing the greatness and prosperity of Germany and putting Germany back on the right track. And democracy was seen as an impediment to all of that. This, I think, is echoes today in the sense that the partisanship is so deep that Trump supporters and the Republican Party, because I think that's where the ill effects of the partisanship mostly, not exclusively, lie, are willing to jettison the procedures and practices of democracy in order to gain hegemony and power in order to make America great again in their vision. And so the supporters, right. to support your enemy and to protect your enemy in order to have a free press, in order to have proper elections, all of that is jettisoned, because the choice is for so many Nazi supporters and middle-class Germans, the German people or Marxism. Get rid of 1918 and accept 1918 and the revolution, or embrace the new vision of the Third Reich in 1933. That's how people saw it. And so they were willing to allow violence, untold violence against the opponents of the Nazis, the closure of the press, and ultimately the destruction of democracy from the local to the state, and then, of course, to the national level.
Right.
The idea that the socialists would return to government, and I'm not talking about communists here. I'm talking about moderate, middle-aged men. That they would be returned to government was worse than anything else. And so in the end, they accepted Hitler. And more than that, Hitler had the soldiers. He had the troops. He had the votes. He was the leader of the largest German party. He had 400,000 people in uniform as a paramilitary troop whose violence suggested that we are going to turn the page. And to turn the page and to get to the next chapter of German history, violence is necessary. We have to get rid of the German Revolution of 1918. We have to fight it and win it rather than lose it as we did in 1918. That's their thinking. So they have to go straight through a civil war before they can get to their Third Reich. And that's why the violence is accepted. That's why the closure of the press and the newspapers is accepted, and that's why a democracy is not mourned, because that is the way to get to this better future.
This is Inside the Hive.
3, 2, 1. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED Politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, it reminds me, and I mean, this is your appearance here today couldn't be more timely, thinking about the statements that we've been hearing from William Barr, the U.S. Attorney General, this week, right? He's talking about charging, you know, protesters with sedition, suing the mayor of Seattle. He said out loud that, you know, if Trump is not reelected, that we're going to be in chaos, right? There's going to be bad things are going to happen, right? This is the head of the Justice Department. He's already showed a willingness to the Trump administration to send military forces into Portland, to use the military against unarmed civilians, and to kind of look the other way when militias who are pro-Trump are creating, you know, violence on the street or bringing guns into the street. And it reminded me, I'm reading your book, about, you know, Hermann Göring issuing, you know, a shoot-to-kill order against quote-unquote terrorists without regard to consequences. I'm reading from your book now. The failure to act against communists was a more serious dereliction of duty than use of excessive force. Like they created a sense that there was so much danger on the other side that anything is justified.
Exactly. And these were terrorists and they were seditious. And so the point of comparison is not the scale. There are far more militiamen in Germany than there are in the United States. The audacity of the Nazi Party is far greater. The ability of the Nazis to rely on traditional German elites may also be greater in the judiciary, in the universities, for example, also in the military. Mm-hmm. But the point of comparison is also that this discourse exists, that political opponents have become political enemies and political traitors. And that the federal government then, under this administration, feels that it has the opportunity and the right to impose a law and order regime of its own making on recalcitrant municipalities and states. None of this we would have imagined 5 years ago, and we see it now. And we also don't see anybody on the other side, on the GOP side, saying this is not right, and elections have to be proper, and the mail has to be delivered, and the ballots counted, and so they're anticipating a chaos that then they can respond to, but they're also creating the chaos. The Nazis always reestablished law and order after fomenting violence and disorder.
Right.
So in a way, cleaning up their own mess in order to tighten the screws of their own rule. And in that sense, we have these similarities. There are also differences, but those would be the similarities. That better Trump than Clinton, better Trump as he is than Democrats, because the Democrats are socialists and seditious. To talk in terms of a culture war is to talk in terms of existential identities, and that is immediately to fracture the American citizenry right down the middle, and you're getting close to calling opponents enemies and traitors.
Oh, well, they've done that, I believe, you know, at least their allies in the press and so forth. And one of the things you point out in the book is, and these analogies, again, are probably broad, but, you know, when Hitler sort of brokers his rise to chancellor of Germany, he does so with the help of other, you know, leaders of other parties who weren't necessarily his allies, but who became kind of convenient partners in it. And I'm talking now about Paul Hindenburg and Franz von Papen, who was mentioned in an interview a couple weeks ago with Stuart Stevens, the GOP strategist. But and the way that he was able to kind of push those guys aside and really claim ultimate power, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but from reading your book, it seems like part of it was to do exactly what we're talking about, create a sense of a permanent state of siege, right?
Exactly. That's the basis of the Constitution of the Third Reich, is a permanent state of war where enemies are constantly lurking to undermine the German nation. And it's just World War One made permanent. Germany surrounded by enemies in the First World War. And this then is the portrait that they have in their heads, that Germany is constantly on the verge of extinction and must preemptively fight, whether it's against socialists and communists in 1933 or against Jews or against the Soviet Union in 1941. The dance that Hitler plays with the elites is a two-step dance. Before he becomes chancellor, he has to dance with them because only they can maneuver him into power. He does not have a parliamentary majority. And so right. They have to be willing to give him emergency powers, and they have to be willing to give him the opportunity of new elections in order to somehow barrel through a parliamentary majority in the next elections. And these elites were reluctant to do so. They wanted Hitler's dynamic party as a partner, but they didn't want Hitler as a highly partisan party leader as chancellor. But then something happened, and that is the November 1932 elections. Germany has tons of elections. Now we're at the last round in 1932. And what the elites see is they see 100 communists enter the Reichstag, the parliament building, and they see 10% of the Nazis leave because they lost votes in that last round of elections. And suddenly the communists are the third largest party in Germany, and quite large, almost as large as the Social Democrats. And this convinces them that they have only now the last opportunity still to use the dynamic forces of the Nazis before they go bankrupt in a new series of elections, and to use those patriotic and nationalist forces in order to destroy democracy and create a new authoritarian state, one in which they think they can control Hitler. This is their moment, and now they're willing to have Hitler as chancellor, whereas before they were not.
Yeah, boy. I mean, the analogy. I mean, the echo of the GOP in, you know, seeing Trump as a controllable populist force, right? Who to whom they lose control, right?
Absolutely,
of the party.
And he has tremendous enthusiasm and passion behind him. He can physically rally the base in ways that they can't, in a way that Cruz can't or Rubio can't. And they see that this popular force they want the energy of that force, but in the end, that's the reason they can't tame Trump, because Trump has all these Democratic treasures. He has the popularity that he has coming out of the primary. He has all these people coming to rallies. So he has this grassroots enthusiasm, and the elites don't have that. They don't have these resources. And so they will very quickly get sidelined. And that's exactly what happens after Hitler comes to power. He doesn't have a lot of Nazis in the cabinet, but he still has this huge percentage of the German vote. He still has many Nazi newspapers. He still has his brown uniform militia men. And that is what determines power in an open democratic society, not the opinions of the elite. So he's very quickly able to outmaneuver them. Once he's in power, he has control over the radio, and he can summon up the enthusiasm of his base, which looks like it's a national uprising, patriotic uprising, and one by one, the right-wing leaders say this is just fine.
Yeah. You describe really interestingly in your book when Adolf Hitler is campaigning, how he, you know, the spectacle of his rallies were these sort of like entertainment spectacles in the countryside, and, you know, the beer halls and the, you know, he'd go out to these sleepy hamlets, and it was almost like a circus had come to town, right? And this was part of his power, right? And you definitely show how later on he kind of brings that to the radio, and he was a master of the media in some way, and he kind of learned how to, you know, deliver on the radio and take that what had been just rallies to the media. And it just, I don't, you know, as I'm reading your book, you don't really mention Trump in, you know, the Hitler's first 100 days, but the underlying similarities are kind of, again, alarming. and I want to just point out that we talk about, you know, well, let's not draw rash historical analogies, but there was just a poll this week that showed among millennials and Generation Z how little many of them know about the consequences of the Holocaust, right? Of a society that said we have to restore, you know, some sort of racial purity to our country, that we need to and that 6 million Jews consequently were killed in the Holocaust. 63% did not know 6 million Jews had died in the Holocaust among, I think it's like 24 to 35. So I only say that as an aside, because we're talking right now about, you know, the rough parallels between the rise of you know, the National Socialists in Germany in the early 30s and what's happening now. But I feel like today, more than ever, it's important for us to be aware of these historical alarms. And I guess part of it, I worry that people have heard Nazi and Hitler abused so much over the years as a kind of bludgeon against one's enemy that we're not paying attention to the details that actually are there, right?
Right. No, and a popular ethnic-based nationalism will weaken and run roughshod over democracy, because the we is completely constituted differently. It's not all citizens, we the people, but it's a particular version of the people, ethnically based. And in Germany, this resonated to the degree that in the World War, 2 million German soldiers died, and 2 million were wounded. And so the body of the people was terribly wounded. And to make appeals to repair this body and to go into a new future of the Third Reich, had a degree of appeal, but it was based on us-them categories that, of course, Hitler elaborated, but also come out of the World War. And this appealed to many, many Germans in 1932 and increasing numbers after 1933, because Hitler was able to portray the Nazis as the representatives, the stewards, the guardians of the nation. His opponents then were traitors. And he did this, he could do this via spectacle with these tremendous rallies, the radio. As a government minister, he had a monopoly on the radio. Political opponents were not allowed to use the radio. And people believed the radio back then more than newspapers because they thought it was direct and unedited.
Right.
And so the sounds of the radio, and I'm not talking about Hitler's words, I'm talking about the applause and the screams of the crowd that people hear through the broadcast, seem to stand in for the jubilation of the nation. And how these rallies were created, it's not that everyone sits around a radio and listens to a Hitler speech that he's giving live somewhere else. These are live events all around the nation. They have their own rallies. They have their own torchlight parades in big town, little town. And then the radio is put onto the market square, and Hitler's speech is broadcast, and the Nazis ask that people turn on their radios and open up their windows so that the sound goes into the streets, the sound of the nation, the sound of the awakening nation goes into the streets. And so people are not passive. They are active participants in these radio broadcast rallies because they have their own rally and parade on the marketplace. And this becomes then a national feeling. What is deceptive about all of this is it's just simply not all Germans. And and Hitler was extremely frustrated. He thought with all this enthusiasm, he must have way over a majority.
Right.
But that never happens. And even in the last elections, you know, we can say they're semi-free. They're more or less accurate. The Nazis only get 43%. Along with their coalition partners, they eke out 52%. This is after months of weeks of campaigning and weeks of radio noise. This is not exactly impressive, but it's enough. It's enough, and the enthusiasm and the momentum and the dynamics and the visuals and the acoustics are all on the Nazi side. They draw in more and more Germans, and so this 52% grows, and people decide to cross the threshold into the Third Reich to see the unity, to see the importance of allegiance and loyalty to Germany, to finally get rid of the political disunity and fragmentation and street fighting that had existed, and to go into the Third Reich. And rally after rally, more and more people cross that threshold, and importantly, more and more people saw their neighbors crossing the threshold, thinking their neighbors had suddenly become convinced and had become converts. And no one knew where the line was between fear, opportunism, and desire. But what you saw were these immense public meetings and assemblies, and that convinces more and more people that this is it. This is the new Germany, whether we like it or not, and we have to make our peace with it. And in fact, there's many good things about it. Comradeship is a virtue. National unity is a virtue. Caring for for the national community and healing it after the World War and the Treaty of Versailles, all those are national virtues. And most social democrats and communists have been veterans themselves in the World War, 60%. And so they could go back to their past as veterans fighting for Germany against the French, and that became a usable past in the Nazi present.
But I mean, one of the other... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just want to just outline some differences, though. And they are, I think, very pertinent. Hitler is a extremely intelligent and dedicated political ideologue who is the leader of the largest political movement that Germany has ever seen. And he's on the cusp of a real revolution. Number two, his base is young, educated, and dynamic. the German universities are the first place that became Nazi. And so it's an extremely young and dynamic, future-oriented base. This is almost the opposite of the rural and rather old base that Trump has.
Right.
And three, Hitler has a militia that becomes an auxiliary to the police within 25 days of him coming to power, at least in the huge state of Prussia. And so suddenly all his bully boys are actually policemen. And this militia is 400,000 people large. That's bigger than the German army and the Prussian police force put together. This is a huge, huge force. And so we have militias now, whereas we had much fewer before. But the scale is very different. Also, the judiciary in Germany, the universities in Germany, all quickly make their peace. All the big institutions that had survived the revolution are nationally inclined, nationalistically inclined, and so it's far easier for them to think that they can work with Hitler than to imagine living under a social democratic rule. And so there are not independent powers that can put checks on the federal authority of Hitler's government. And that's, of course, different also in the United States.
This is Inside the Hive.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
As we've been watching, Donald Trump has attempted to politicize all these otherwise independent institutions, you know, from the CDC to the Justice Department, and to the degree he can, you know, control otherwise independent institutions, he kind of consolidates power and in ways that are a little bit, you know, frightening. Now, we don't want to overstate that, and I don't want to overstate the analogy with Nazi Germany, but I will say that I got interested in talking to you after, and I'm a person who had been skeptical for a long time of ever drawing those analogies, even saying that he's a fascist. I mean, I would always in my mind say, this is America. I mean, come on, right? But one thing leads to another, and the next thing you know, you see Donald Trump having a convention event on the lawn of the White House, and the spectacle of it being so, nationalistic, but seeming to be taking the people's White House and using it as a kind of propaganda force. And I would also say, just, and you could tell me what you think about this, but yes, the demographics of Trump's following are older, and he certainly doesn't have a lot of following in the universities in the country. But there are these sort of independent groups that we're seeing cropping up who are younger, kind of right-leaning, and in some cases violent groups, you know, the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys. Now, these might be, you know, seem marginal, but we're seeing more and more of them. And they seem to be kind of moving into the center of the conversation, whereas they might have been not, you know, even 5 years ago.
I think that's a very good point, because if you look at the history of Germany before there were lots of Nazis running around, there were a lot of nationalist groups running around with all sorts of names, some armed, some not armed. And so it's not the Nazis who invent these nationalist groups that persecute Jews, that hound socialists, and so on, that existed throughout the 1920s. And so, and then they transformed themselves, and many entered the ranks of the SA, the brown shirts. So the analogy is that you have these things in America at all. They might not yet, or they might not be of the same size, but we didn't think in these terms about America 5 or 6 years ago. As you said, well, this is America. And the America that you have in mind is a fair play, checks and balances, and democratic procedure, and the rights of the minority. And the America that's in MAGA is very different. The make America great means that they're villains who have undone America. But there are now the virtuous who can remake America and make it great again. I call it muscular populism. Muscular melodramatic populism, because it relies on villains and heroes, villains and the virtuous, one who destroyed America, the villains, and two, the virtuous who will remake America. So it's very muscular. Trends about globalization or post-industrial economy or all of that is irrelevant. It's a melodramatic game between the villainous and the virtuous.
That's right.
And that's their vision of America, and that's not the vision of America that is expressed in the statement, oh, my God, of course, this is America, right? So there's different conceptions about the Constitution, about fair play, and respecting your opponent.
Right. Well, and we, you know, this election, the intensity of it, the historical import of it is revolving around exactly that, what you're talking about, the conception of what this country is going to be. You know, on the right it's America or socialism.
Right, and the importance of a white ethnic America is much more important in Trump's campaign than the vision of a Aryanized Germany was in Hitler's electoral campaigns.
That's interesting.
People are voting not on the economy, but on identity and culture. And it's not that their personal finances have suffered, but they see that other people have cut in line and are getting government resources that they haven't earned. And so the economy is seen through this lens of racial resentment and ethnic resentment. And that's very big right now. And for the German electorate, more and more, the Jewish question became more and more important and more central, and Jews were just aghast at all of this. But the election didn't turn on German Aryan identity in the same way as it is today. But then very quickly, Germans became very fluent in these categories of Aryan and non-Aryan. And made them their own.
Right. Well, and maybe you can speak for a minute about some of the affinities between the Nazi Germany in that early 30s and what was going on in the United States at the time. Talk a little bit about for a minute about Charles Lindbergh, for instance. There's a new book out called Cast. It's like maybe on the bestseller list. And it points out that, you know, when the Germans were architecting the Nazis were architecting their own government and ideas, they looked to the United States to see, you know, for instance, Jim Crow laws and other kinds of the way our legal system managed to institutionalize, racism. Can you talk about that?
Well, with Jim Crow, that is a very grassroots movement enforced by the individual actions of so many people, both in the South and the North, about what was right in terms of who could sit where, who could be where they were. And it was really enforced at every level of social interaction. It is true that anti-Semitism rises, and the book that German Jews had to warn them away from certain spas and hotels grows in the number of pages throughout the 1920s. And so that's a grassroots anti-Semitism by hotel owners and restaurant owners, but it's not a imposed anti-Semitic regime like Jim Crow. So in that sense, I think that there are differences, and it's amazing that Jim Crow is still in so many ways alive in terms of voter suppression and the like. What's interesting about looking at America 1932 and Germany 1932 is that, one thing is when Roosevelt was elected in November 1932, there were all sorts of parties. I mean, Prohibition was still there, but people danced out of joy. At least Democrats did, but it was an overwhelming victory. Nazis don't dance. They march.
That's interesting.
That's one difference. The other is only 2% of Americans in the November election voted for either the communists or the socialists. So people still stayed with the two parties, the two system parties. So there was not anti-system, there wasn't system disloyalty in the same degree to which you had in Germany, where the communists and the Nazis have a actual negative majority in the parliament. And Roosevelt spoke on the radio to friends, said, my friends. Hitler did not refer to Germans in these intimate and friendly ways. Americans blamed themselves for the Great Depression. You have all sorts of poets and artists and reporters on the road in 31, 32, 33, and uniformly they talk about the disorientation of Americans, the fear, the sense that they blame themselves, that they don't quite comprehend what has happened. In Germany, people saw this in very partisan terms. The revolution had occurred. The Soviet Union is down the block, so to speak, in Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. And they see things in very, very political partisan terms, socialists, fascists, Nazis, and they blame the system. And they don't blame themselves. So those are some of the differences. Anti-Roosevelt and anti-New Deal sentiment will grow in the late 1930s, especially when associated with the possibility of a American intervention in another European war. And so you have a new group of leaders of prominent figures, including Charles Lindbergh, who not only, he's a very eloquent and handsome man. I think he's actually a likable person one-to-one. But his vision of America is up from Minnesota. It's white, it's rural, it has, as his wife said, the cadence of the old West. It is not comfortable with the cities, with the big city press. Certainly not after the kidnapping and murder of his little child and all the hoopla around that. And so he goes back to an older America and appeals to that. That is the America that should not go into a new world war. And that is the America that should not let itself be misled by the British and the Jews, who have justifiable interests, but they are not American interests. That is what he said at Des Moines, 9/11, 1941, at the America First, notorious America First rally. And so he divided Americans, and Jews were not Americans. And the American interest was not to be co-defined by them. And so he had that same kind of, by the time we get to 1941, he had that same kind of us-them idea, and a very old-fashioned, kind of virtuous, rural, real America view of the United States that was not coextensive with New York City or Los Angeles or the movies or advertisements.
Right. Well, and that's one of the things I took from your book, by the way, is that, you know, as the Nazis are coming to power, Berlin is sort of this recalcitrant hotbed of, you know, socialists, other kinds of political parties, and they're slowly kind of drowned out by the Nazis over time. And but there was, interestingly, in parallel to some degree, some kind of distrust of what was going on in the cosmopolitan areas, politically.
Well, that's certainly true, because your average worker in Germany is unemployed, and he does not live on the main drags with the neon lighting in Berlin, and he's resentful of that too. They have most workers have always voted socialist and communist, but the Nazis can pry into that majority and talk about what has this Weimar state done for you, this cosmopolitan elitist state with all this jazz and the neon lights downtown. That's not going to help you. And so the Nazis were able to nibble into the working class vote. It's wrong to suggest that the Nazis didn't have workers behind them. They did. But most workers remained loyal to the socialists and the communists. But as I say, they were able to nibble. And also what's distinctive about the Nazis is the richer the precinct, the bigger the Nazi vote. So when you analyze the Clinton-Trump counties, you know, all the rich counties are with Clinton, all the poor counties are with Trump. That would be the opposite case in Germany. The rich precincts would have been overwhelmingly Nazi, and the poor precincts would have had the higher socialist and communist votes, and some Nazis.
Right. Yeah. Well, and to draw a little bit more parallel, it's a little bit of a misnomer to think it was just the white working class, you know, that brought Trump into power. There were a lot of wealthy middle class, educated, you know, white male voters.
Exactly.
Who, you know, and you think about the McCloskeys in Wisconsin, you know, they're these wealthy suburbanites.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, anyway, we could go on and on with this, and I would love to. But I have to wind down this conversation right now, Peter. But I want to thank you, Peter Fritchie, for coming on this show and really educating us what history can tell us. Hitler's first 100 days when Germans embraced the Third Reich. This is a crucial time to be educating ourselves and our young people, frankly, after looking at this poll I spoke of earlier. And I think all of us should be going into this election, into this fall, with our eyes wide open and arms with this kind of education. So thank you very much, Peter, for coming on
to
Inside the
Hive.
And that's our podcast this week. I'd like to thank my co-host, Emily Jane Fox, and of course, our sterling producer, Bob Tabador at Cadence 13. If you want to hear more episodes of Inside the Hive, you can subscribe at Apple or radio.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'd like to thank our sponsors. Please support them the way they support this podcast, and we will see you next week.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS, just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.